Ocean Policy this afternoon on January the 30th, 2007. And welcome to everyone. It's nice to have so many faces today. We don't often have this many people for our committee, so yeah. That's very good. We're getting down to some interesting things, obviously. And we're going to move right along. There are going to be just a few ground rules, unfortunately. We're going to have to ask you to make your presentations on the first bill that we will be hearing because of the number of people who want to testify. We just can't be here all afternoon. I will be willing to move something off of the agenda if it looks like we're going to run over time, because I will be closing the meeting at 5 o'clock. And so, having said that, I'm going to open a work session, public hearing on House Bill 2197, and I'd call Ken Kine. I'm going to call three at a time, Hasina Squires and Mark Adams. Chief Mark Adams, that is. And if you'll introduce yourself for the record, please.
For the record, my name is Kent Kime. I'm the State 911 Program Manager. Co-Chair Representative Boone, Co-Chair Senator Berger, and members of the committee. My name is Kent Kime. I'm the 911 Program Administrator for Oregon Emergency Management. I'm here to testify on HB 2197, which removes the sunset from the 911 program tax. Currently, there are two bills that have been pre-session filed pertaining to the sunset on the 911 program tax. HB 2197, which we are here today to discuss, eliminates the sunset on sunset.
Thank you.
And HB 2369, which extends the sunset to December 31st, 2014, and was a part of the governor's package of bills of the legislature. I support the continuation of the tax, as this program has been in existence for over 25 years and has proven its worth in providing a robust statewide 911 system has been able to keep up to date with technology that is constantly changing the way we communicate. With various current and emerging technologies such as wireless, voice over internet protocol, personal devices, and text messaging, we are continually facing calls for help in a multitude of formats. This funding allows the 911 program to keep up with these emerging technologies and provide the citizens of Oregon with the ability to dial 911 from anywhere in Oregon on the latest equipment capable of receiving these various types of calls and routing them to the proper 911 dispatch center for dispatch. Each corner of Oregon has the same type of technology in use, which allows the PSAPs to answer these calls and dispatch emergency personnel to our citizens in a time of need. This current biennium has a budget of $66 million, which is collected from any device or circuit capable of accessing 911, which is about 3.9 million devices and circuits in the state. Now, this money collected quarterly by our telecommunications providers, approximately $9.3 million, up to 4% is kept by the 911 program staff for administration, 35% is transferred into the E911 sub-account and is used to purchase telephone equipment, network, database, mapping, and routing equipment to get the 911 call to the proper answering point. The remaining funds are distributed to local governments and forwarded to the PSAP that is responsible for answering and dispatching the 911 calls to assist them in their funding. In this current biennium, the 50 911 answering points in Oregon to date have handled over 2.3 million calls for 911 services, 1.2 million calls on a 10-digit emergency line, and 3.9 million calls for other information requests to warrant confirmations. 911 has played an important role in keeping Oregon citizens up to date with technology, allowing them to access to the emergency reporting system, which is needed statewide with the same level of current technology available to everyone in Oregon. The governor has proposed a three-biennium extension of 911 tax in his bill 2369, which is in his package of bills. The important focus in both of these bills is that they keep 911 funds supporting the programs and agencies that serve Oregon citizens with a robust 911 reporting system available to them in their time of need. Thank you. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Kine. We're going to hold questions and move right on.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chairs, for the record, and members of the committee, for the record. My name is Hasina Squires. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon APCO NENA Association, which is a professional association that represents 911 managers throughout the state of Oregon. I'm also here today on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon, which represents 900 special service districts, which include approximately 300 rural fire protection districts. In order to save the committee a little bit of time, Ken Armstrong is going to come and testify with Chief Adams and myself, and we've got a number of local people in the room, so I'll save you a little bit of time and just represent that Ken Armstrong was here to testify in support of the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association and also the Oregon Fire District Directors Association, which represents the elected officials of the 300 rural fire protection districts. My testimony is attached to the handout that gives a breakdown of the sort of the history of the 911 tax, and since we do have a lot of local people in the room and you see me every day in the building, I will keep my comments to be very brief and just provide you with just a little bit of background on the 911 tax. The first 911 system in Oregon was a basic 911 system that was established in March of 1971 in the small town of Milton Freewater. We've really come quite a long way and actually have been become known in the United States as a program who has a leading 911 state program. And I think I would just like to point out that we really are a leader in the 911 community throughout the United States, and it's due to a great deal of partnership between our cities, our counties, our special districts, and the state 911 program. Some states have adversarial relationships with the state program. We do not. We cooperate. We communicate. We work together through tough times. And I just really want to commend the staff at the state agency and working with the locals so closely on issues as we've grown and developed. In 1981, the Oregon State Legislature issued a mandate for state 911 service, and at that time there were 80 911 basic systems and approximately 220 dispatch centers. By the time that state mandate was completed in 1991, there were 60 primary public safety answering points and 31 secondary PSAPs. On January 1, 1991, Oregon became only the sixth state in the United States to have state 911 service on a statewide basis. So we've been always progressive with our 911 program. Currently, there are 50 primary public safety answering points, 13 secondary PSAPs, and two regional dispatch centers that are operated by OSP. The funding, this is a little brief history on the funding of the program. In 1981, there was a 3% surcharge tax that was instituted on subscriber lines capable of accessing 911. In 1991, the legislature increased that surcharge from 3% to 5% to fund additional enhancements to the system known as enhanced wireless 911s, which means when you pick up your cell phone, the 911 call center can locate you. In 1995, we changed that 5% tax to a flat fee of 75 cents per line of capable of accessing 911, and that was to provide, at the time, it was intended to be revenue neutral, and it was also intended to provide better stability and prediction for local governments in budgeting how they would be able to, what revenue would be coming in. I've provided a funding allocation of exactly how the money is distributed. As you can see, the bulk of the money that is distributed by the program, 57.5%, is used at the local level, but it only accounts for 20% of, on average, statewide of 911 centers' budgets. So there's a huge cost that's being picked up by local agencies, either through user fees, property tax-supported revenue. So the 911 tax is just a small but very important part of those funding and of that funding. So we encourage you to extend the tax. And with that, I'd be happy to answer your questions. Chief Adams.
Madam Co-Chair, committee, I'm Chief Mark Adams of the Kaiser Police Department, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. The 911 system in place in Oregon is critical to the public safety mission that we perform. And I'm going to talk a little bit about our support of the elimination of the sunset, but also how we got to where we're at. Back in the 70s when I first started, I was like, you know, graveyard shift, dispatch called in sick. You had a policeman like me, like Aunt B, with a little microphone answering the phone to what we have today, which is a modern, well-tuned system. And I was asked to talk about how a call goes through 911. I'm the chair of the Willamette Valley Communications Center Advisory Committee, so I can tell you how it works here. When a call comes in anywhere in Marion, Polk counties, when you call 911 It goes into a center in Salem. A professional call taker takes the call, immediately knows where you're calling from, is able to pass that information via computer instantly to a dispatcher who is, now knows which agency, whether it's fire, police, state police, whoever might need that call, it goes out to them. And we have that instant connection to the person needing help. They can vector us in where we need to go and get us there in a hurry. That system, that 75-cent tax is what's keeping that all together, that and the other charges we, the different cities and counties provide. So I'll be very quick just to express our very strong support that this tax continues.
Thank you very much. I'm going to call the next three people. Ken Armstrong, Larry Hatch, and Laura Wolf.
Madam Chair, must be South Kaiser. Madam Chair, it must be South Kaiser. The chief must be from South Kaiser.
Oh, absolutely.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, Ken Armstrong representing the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association, and also here this afternoon to carry the representation of the Oregon District Fire District Directors Association to communicate our support for moving forward with the extension of the 911 tax. The fire service feels that there is virtually no other issue that's as critical as maintaining an efficient and well-running 911 system, and I just want to lend our support to the effort, and don't want to extend your time and turn it over to some of the experts. So with that, I'll go ahead and close.
Madam Co-Chairs, committee members.
You'll move your mic, move the microphone, please. Thank you.
My name is Larry Hatch. I'm the Assistant Director of the Washington County 911 Center. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill today. This funding has allowed Oregon to be a leader in the 911 industry. Oregon was one of the first three states to have border-to-border enhanced 911, giving our 911 centers the ability to receive the telephone number and location from which a 911 call was made. Then the cellular telephone market exploded on us, and dollars from this fund helped the PSAPs get the technology necessary to locate cellular callers as well. Our 911 dollars funded upgrades to centers, and right now we're approximately 80% complete with statewide deployment of that technology for cellular phone calls. The revenue is crucial to the operation of the Washington County 911 Center, supplying 20.6% of our funding, and I included our latest budget chart in my testimony. The enhanced 911 subaccount has also funded equipment upgrades to our center, and then last year replaced our 10-year-old telephone 911 telephone system with a brand new telephone. As I monitored the work of the Interim Subcommittee on Emergency Preparedness, I was proud of the recognition our state 911 program received during the discussion of the 911 tax, the sunset, and continuing the funding. When one of the members said, sunsets are for programs to prove themselves, and this program has definitely proven itself, it made me very proud to be a part of the 911 system in Oregon. I personally feel there is no need for a sunset on this program. The funding is needed to continue 911 operations statewide and to upgrade equipment vital to our 911 mission, and to deal with the next big technology shift that will take place and put new requirements on us. However, some of our partners in delivering this service to our citizens feel the sunset is necessary and should not be eliminated. Continuation of the funding is not the question, only whether the sunset should be continued, and I'll leave that decision in your hands and know that you'll do the best for the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that testimony. Laura?
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Laura Wolf. I'm with the City of Madam Chairs, members of the committee. I'm with the City of Portland 911 Center, and I'm here today to support House Bill 2197, and without reiterating what everyone has touched on about the technology and the need for this, I'm here to support the extension of the telephone tax. The City of Portland strongly supports the elimination of the sunset on this tax. We believe it is in the best interest of all to reduce the time and energy spent every few years to come before the legislature to renew a tax that has gained a broad-based acceptance by the public who expect their emergency calls to be answered and responded to in an expedient and professional manner. Therefore, on behalf of the City of Portland, I ask for your support in passing this bill, which will provide permanent funding for this critical program that serves all of our residents and constituencies across the state.
Thank you very much, Laura. I'll call up the next three. James Bella, Richard Glasgow, and Sally Jones. Welcome. Who's going to start? Introduce yourself for the record, please.
My name is James Vila. I'm president and founder of Oregon Earthquake Awareness, Portland, Oregon. On March 25, 1993, the ground shook in Tillamook on the coast. It was 5:28 a.m., and the local emergency manager had been trained, if you feel the ground shake, go to high ground. He phoned the state OEM in Salem. They were closed. Everyone knew that the earthquake couldn't hurt you if it were after sundown. Call was routed to 911 in Portland. Was that an earthquake, he asked. Operator replied, I don't know any more than you do, and I have 911 calls to answer. I kind of taking the position that I would like this tax to ride off into the sunset. As I read this bill, it's not eliminating the 911, just this tax. And my phone bill must have a dozen taxes tagging onto it already. And when I went to the statute, it's under the heading Tax for Emergency Communications. It's not clear, and it takes a lot of effort to see whether the tax money can go to anything other than 911 calls. From my research, I think the intent is that it does not. But what I'm saying is I feel that we all strongly benefit from the 911 system, and that we therefore should all share the cost to the general fund, perhaps even a minimal tourism or convention services tax as an indirect cost. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bell. Yes?
Good afternoon, Madam Co-Chairs, distinguished members of the board here. My name is Richard Glasgow. I'm the Executive Director of Lincoln County Communications Agency, the 911 public safety answering point in the middle of the coast here in Oregon. Instead of reading my brief statement here that I've prepared, I'd like to tell you a story how this tax immediately impacted members of the community in Newport. In June of this past year, I used to be the commanding officer of the Coast Guard Station in Newport. We received a call over radio that the master of a vessel had been stabbed multiple times by his crew member. His crew member had taken over the vessel somewhere off of Newport. He had no way to relay his position to the Coast Guard. We launched a helicopter, launched two boats to go search for him somewhere off of Newport. Didn't have a chance of finding him without the accurate information on his position. Got into the radio room, had the radio man call this member. He called 911 on a cellular telephone to the PSAP there in Newport. The PSAP in Newport received the phone call, was able to pass on his latitude and longitude down to within 3 meters of his exact position. We put a helicopter on top of the vessel, sent two boats out with law enforcement boarding teams, went on board, took control of the situation, brought the member back alive. And that's the best example I can give on the partnership that we have, not just with the Coast Guard and the PSAPs, but the impact of this bill to the community there right in Newport. And that's just one story of thousands that happen every day. Thank you.
Thank you for that testimony.
Co-Chair Verger, Co-Chair Boone, and members of the committee. My name is Sally Jones. I'm the administrator for Columbia 911 Communications District. I'm also co-chair of the Oregon APCO NENA Legislative Committee and a board member on the Special Districts Insurance Trust. I'm testifying today in support of House Bill 2197. I think that it's very important to emphasize that the Oregon 911 system and how it is funded is a model of partnerships and preparedness. 30 years ago, most emergency services had individual in-house call centers and dispatch centers. The public had to find and call seven-digit phone numbers to be able to reach them. Coordination between responders to incidents was difficult at best, ineffectual at worst. Fast forward 30 years, and I've worked all that time in the system. The reality is now in Oregon, anyone, anywhere in our state, using many types of technology, can call three well-known numbers, 911, and speak to the correct dispatcher for the correct type of emergency service they need. They'll receive professional direction on what to do until the responders arrive. And communication between responders is well coordinated, often originating from the same center. Getting to where we are today required the partnership between city police, county sheriffs, city fire departments, fire districts, emergency medical first responders, private ambulance, public ambulance, public works agencies, everyone partnering together in the best sense of the term, combining resources, coordinating procedures, seeking better ways to serve the public together, resulted in reducing the number of emergency call taking and dispatch centers, and more importantly, providing better service to people needing our help. The funding provided by the 911 excise tax has played a critical role in making these partnerships possible and establishing Oregon as a role model for the rest of the nation. This funding established the statewide emergency call reporting network and continues to support the ability for access to it by all the changing technologies. It supports the state 911 standardized professional certification program for call takers and dispatchers, also a model for the rest of the nation, and ongoing certification maintenance. The state 911 program office works very closely with local public safety answering points to make sure that technical standards and efficiencies are the same whether the 911 call is placed and received in Lake County or in downtown Portland. The same level. On average, 20 to 25% of the operations funding needed to run each public safety answering point is provided by this tax. The remaining 75 to 80% for operations of our centers is provided by local tax resources through partnerships established by the local police, fire, emergency medical, public works, even private ambulances and private entities. All public safety answering points and dispatch centers are involved in coordinated response and emergency preparedness planning for routine and escalated events. Again, great examples of the benefits of partnering for the best response we can provide and for preparedness for large events. In summary, Oregon 911 is strong because of its partnerships. The partnerships and funding between local and state, partnerships in coordinated local response, and partnerships in joint emergency preparedness activities. On behalf of Columbia 911, Oregon APCO NENA, and Special Districts Association of Oregon, we urge your continuing support of the 911 excise tax, and we thank you for your hard work and partnership in emergency preparedness. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you very much. I'm going to call up the next three. Brant Wolf, Renee Weiler or Willer, Christy Wild,
Madam Co-Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Brant Wolf. I represent the Oregon Telecommunications Association, and the OTA is a trade association that represents all the telecom providers, wireline providers that collect and remit the 911 fund back to the state. For the purposes of my testimony today, I'm also going to speak on behalf of the wireless carriers that operate throughout the state. I've circulated my testimony and some other documents. Basically, the point I want to make sure that you guys know today is that the OTA and our members support the 911 fee and what the 911 fee accomplishes. However, we would like the sunset provision to carry on. We would not support repealing the sunset provision. We believe it's appropriate for the state legislature to periodically review the revenue generated from the 911 fee and what that revenue is being used for. We believe that's the prudent and appropriate responsibility of the legislature. In the alternative, we would like this committee to favorably consider the amendment that's being circulated today, or favorably consider the passage of House Bill 2369, which would also extend the sunset out to a period, I think, of 2014. To summarize, the OTA fully supports the 911 system, the PSAP system, and all the hardworking men and women who are emergency responders and who work in the PSAP system. We just think it's appropriate to have a sunset provision for this particular fee. That ends my testimony.
Thank you very much. Next. Madam Co-Chairs and committee members, my name is Renee Willer, and I represent Verizon. Verizon is a communications and broadband company serving Oregon customers in many counties. We are also partners with the Oregon Office of Emergency Management and the various 911 agencies. We support the continuation of the 911 surcharge and all the good work that it does, but we can't support the bill in its current form because it eliminates the surcharge sunset provision. We would like to see a periodic review of the fund to see that it's funded at the appropriate level. Is the surcharge rate, the 75 cents, still needed? How is the money being used? And so we would also support the amendment that is currently being circulated that would extend the sunset provision until 2012, or House Bill 2369 that would extend the sunset provision to 2014. That concludes my testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. All right.
Madam Co-Chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Christy Wild, and I serve as Communications Manager for Central Lane 911. The City of Eugene supports the passage of House Bill 2197 and the elimination of the sunset of the 911 telephone tax. The 911 tax provides approximately $1.2 million a year to provide emergency call taking at Central Lane Communications, which is a primary PSAP administered by the City of Eugene, serving 294,000 residents in Lane County. These funds are leveraged with over $3.7 million of local monies in order to provide call taking, dispatch, and a broad range of public safety services. The loss of 911 tax funding would result in reduced day-to-day services and the inability to keep up with new technology, which our citizens rely on in emergencies. You've already heard a lot of examples of what this tax pays for. This past June at our center, it provided an upgrade to a digital phone system, which will put us in a good position to work with the new technology people will use when they attempt to reach 911. It's in the best interest of the state to maintain a consistent and efficient 911 network. This dedicated tax is vital in order to provide the citizens of Oregon immediate and direct contact with emergency services. We have no issues with regular review of how the services are going, but the City of Eugene encourages your positive action on House Bill 2197. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. We have two more people to testify on this bill, Scott Winkles and Mike Dewey.
Hmm.
Mike Dewey.
How are you doing? I apologize.
It's quite all right.
Chair Verger, Chair Boone, members of the committee. For the record, I am Scott Winkles, representing the League of Oregon Cities, and I'm appearing in favor of House Bill 2197. In the interest of avoiding redundancy, I have crossed out large sections of my testimony, and I would just like to add our voice to the support for passage of this bill and point out that the 75-cent per line 911 tax provides local government with 20% of their call center operating costs, as well as with much-needed revenue for 911 improvements. Should the 911 tax ever fail to be renewed, local governments would lose funds that could not readily be replaced from other sources. Rather, local governments would be forced to cut service levels in other areas in order to maintain their emergency service needs. The LSC feels that the elimination of the sunset provision of the 911 tax will give cities a secure, dedicated source of revenue that will help with emergency communication costs for today and help meet the needs of communities in the future. I look forward to your questions.
Mike?
Madam Co-Chairs and committee members, my name is Mike Dewey. I represent the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association. It may be a surprise to some of you, but cable companies in Oregon, some provide, if you will, a telephony service. Comcast and Bend and Charter will be doing this in Southern Oregon. And they are voluntarily paying the 911 tax, if you will, in the sense that because of the definitions, and it changes from time to time, as to what this voice over internet protocol service is. It's not an intrastate service, it's an interstate service, so therefore, arguably, it's not subject to the 911 charges. But we are firm believers in 911. The services that we provide to our customers, which is growing every day, it is essential if you're going to provide that service to have 911. And you've heard in the past about Vantage and others as to whether or not these public switched internet services can provide 911 in an efficient way. It's a little bit different than our networks that are basically our cable networks and the contracts that we have and internal networks. So when a 911 comes over our infrastructure, and I'll take just a minute, those calls, I mean, you could have a video signal, you could have a data signal, or you could have the telephony or the voice signal. And it's, you know, zeros and ones. It's all digital. And the, if you will, the freeway is such that 911 takes the lead, and that's the call that goes forward. So the data service may be a little bit slower speeds. This morning I had an opportunity to see how much money we're talking about. And there's a lot of money. And I think, from our perspective, the cable industry, it is good from time to time to take a look at how the money is spent. I'm sure it's spent very nicely, but a four-year sunset, I think that's a proposal that is out there, makes a whole lot of sense. It seems to me this is an oversight responsibility that you have. And notwithstanding how many good things people are doing and how important this is, the money may grow very fast. And I saw a chart that it does grow pretty fast, and we have sunsets all the time. Folks that work on healthcare matters know with mandates, we have a sunset every 6 years. And it's an opportunity to go back and look at what's changed. And believe me, things will change in telecommunications. And from that standpoint, that oversight is important. And you may have some ways of looking at this for some additional efficiencies. So with that, we think the sunset is very appropriate. And I appreciate your time, and I apologize for being late to the podium.
Thank you very much. If you'll step back now, I'm going to say to the committee, actually, the bill, as encouraging us to continue with 911 is probably no argument. Everybody here wants it to continue. The question for the committee now is whether you have a repeal or a sunset. I would like for some committee members to make comments, particularly those who favor an amendment. If you favor an amendment, if you would also state at what year or what period of time you would like that sunset to be there in the amendment. So I open it to discussion for that. Anyone with a comment on the amendment or when the sunset, when you'd like the amendment you like?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you for this opportunity. I just think, first of all, the citizens of this state are so fortunate to have such men and women responding to 911. And having most recently done so myself, I, you know, saved my life. And so anyway, I'm very, very grateful. I think the bill should pass, certainly, and I think a sunset is great. I think we need to be custodians of our bankers' money, and I think that's the right way to go.
All right. Any other comments?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you.
Senator Durf.
I better speak up on this one. As you know, when the legislature tried to rob this account, I swore that that was not going to happen. And so you worry about accounts like this. That wouldn't stop the legislature from coming back and trying to rob it again, though. So I think it's very important that we state here today that we all support 911. But I'm going to be bringing forward for all of your consideration a Texas-style sunset. And the reason that they do that in Texas, and we've talked with them on programs and boards and commissions that don't seem to be doing what they were originally intended to do, was that you need review. And so that's why I agree with the governor and I, has proposed a three biennium. I'm happy with three or two, but I would like to see a continuation of sunset.
All right. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2197, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2371. I'm going to ask our administrative assistant to tell us a little bit about this particular bill.
House Bill 2371 requires certain health and child care facilities to adopt emergency plans that provide for the safety of persons receiving services from facilities when faced with threat of imminent danger.
All right. We have some people to testify on this bill. I'll call James Bella, Lauren Rhodes, and Jane Ellen Whiteland. I hope that's close.
Okay, I'll start.
Go for it.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lauren Rhodes. I represent the Oregon Healthcare Association. We are a trade association that represents long-term care facilities across the state of Oregon, including nursing facilities, assisted living, and residential care facilities, independent senior housing, and licensed in-home care agencies. And I have prepared some written testimony that's being passed out, and I would like to just start by saying we're not taking a formal position on this bill. We're neutral in terms of the concepts. We support the direction that the bill takes. We just wanted to share some information with the committee that might help in terms of where you head in terms of where this bill ends up. We actually do believe that this many provisions of this bill are actually already in existing law as they apply to licensed long-term care facilities in terms of requiring facilities to have emergency plans in place in order to maintain their licensure. So that's what we wanted to make sure the committee was aware. We actually had been working with legislative council to get their opinion on the existing statutes, and they are in the process of creating a draft. Unfortunately, with their overwhelming workload right now, legislative or council opinions are taking a backseat to bill drafts. So I did see a draft of the opinion. It's forthcoming. And with respect to the licensed facilities that I'm discussing in terms of nursing facilities, assisted living, and residential care facilities, they do appear to agree that these requirements are already in place. I also had a conversation with the state fire marshal's office this morning, and they also indicated that they are of similar belief that many of these provisions are already in existing statute. And so with that, I would just like to offer what I think is important in terms of the bill and the direction that we're heading, and that is that facilities are committed to maintaining good and stable emergency preparedness plans, and that they are looking to work with their public and private partners in order to make sure that these plans cover all of the details that everyone would expect to have in place. We have been working with the Department of Human Services to revise rules as they apply to licensed facilities and to make more explicit the provisions that emergency plans must have. That's been a rulemaking process that's been going on since last fall, and we're continuing to work to revise those rules. Probably, I would expect them to come out at some point this year. So with that, I would be willing to answer any questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, recently up in Oregon City, there was a fire in a facility, and they seemed to, from what I saw, they did a pretty good job of getting folks out of there and getting them where they belong. Did they have a plan up there on their books that they worked for and drilled for? Do you know the answer?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Schaffler, I do. That was last weekend in Oregon City. It was a two-alarm fire, and actually all of the residents were safely evacuated and transported across the street, I believe, into local facilities that were able to take in the residents. And it was a very successful operation, and they did have an emergency plan in place. They followed their procedures, and it went according to plan, from what I understand.
Thank you.
Other questions? Yes, Representative Nelson.
Thank you. Madam Chair, and thank you all for being here. Appreciate it. I guess I have great concern about the transportation of these individuals and those that, you know, are tied up to oxygen and all those other things they have. And we have been collecting from all the counties their emergency preparedness plans because none of them are coordinated, you know, in a five-state area or anything like that. But we seem not to want to deal with that. So I'm just curious, that seems to be lacking everywhere and even here today.
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Nelson, I think transportation is certainly an important issue and something that I included a draft of the rules that are under consideration and what the stakeholders and the department are considering, and one specific requirement is for plans to have transportation provisions and to have a detailed plan for how they would transport residents in the event of a total evacuation or a partial evacuation. So that's certainly something that is under scrutiny and certainly an important consideration of all plans that would be required to have them in place. And it's important discussion that needs to be had at a broader level, which is really the message that we wanted to deliver today, is that we are looking to work with our emergency responders and emergency managers in the counties to make sure that those discussions and those conversations take place prior to an event so that everyone is aware of existing resources that may be out there and that everyone does not rely on the same transportation system or other redundant measures so that everyone can make sure that they have plans in place that will account for those sorts of considerations.
Senator Jones.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is my first exposure to this bill, having not had the opportunity to sit through this work that happened in the interim. But I'm very persuaded by your testimony on its face that much of this may already exist. Have you given any thought to how much additional cost it would be to your members if there was another overlay of training where it requires training for all employees? And what I'm trying to get at is if you already have plans in place, there's already training going on, as evidenced by Representative Schaffler's successful evacuation in Oregon City, and you're now given another set of rules with another set of training requirements, have you given any thought to additional cost?
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, I think that's an excellent question, and it's certainly something that we would want to dig deeper into. I think that where I'm looking to get some counsel from the Legislative Council office is that would this be another layer of regulation, or does it simply duplicate existing regulation? And that's where I think I'd seek their expertise in terms of determining whether or not it would add another layer of mandated training requirements.
Just a comment of follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
My other concern about this is that I very much support the concept of planning, and I think we were all given a lesson in the Katrina disaster with respect to training, but I'm trying to figure out where's that fine line between wonderful training, plans in place, and the motivation to cause human beings to do heroic things in the face of imminent danger. I don't think that we can legislate that someone would have the heart and the courage to stay behind if they decide to flee. And my concern is overlaying requirements on facilities that are already being asked to do a lot financially. And so it's just a comment that I don't know how we can legislate human behavior to execute the plan when the tsunami is coming or the conflagration is burning over the hill.
Good comment. Lauren, I was hoping that you would have some response from Legislative Council.
Madam Co-Chair, they have a draft opinion, and I was able to see it in Legislative Council office yesterday, but they were not able to issue it to me. And so I would offer that to the committee to pursue if you have an opportunity.
Representative Cowan and then Senator Morset.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've spoken with Ms. Rhodes and mentioned some of my concerns in this, so I just sort of want to get them on the record. Beyond just the licensed facilities, I'm particularly focusing, although the child care facilities are certainly important, I'm particularly focusing on any facility that houses the senior population, and that my concern is basically that this bill doesn't go far enough in addressing some of the minimum standards necessary beyond evacuation for large-scale disasters, because the desire would be to care for people in the case of our expected natural disasters that we're going to continue to have in place. And specifically, my concern is around heat and an ability to generate an alternate source of heat, which in the last windstorm, we were without power in some of our facilities in Lincoln County for about 6 days. And I've had reports that some were needing to open ovens to keep people warm, and that's not acceptable to me. So it's fine if we address this in administrative rule or some way that we have confidence that a work group continues. But I do think this needs to go just a little bit farther in directing an activity to take place, not just around current regulations, but responsible planning for the whole range of facilities. So that's what I need to say.
Senator Morset?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I, too, feel that this bill is lacking in some areas. For instance, nursing homes facilities within the inundation zone. This doesn't mention inundation zone. We're talking about, I'm talking about a specific incident that will happen at some point, a tsunami, an earthquake. I think there has to be an immediate planned response, not just by the nursing home, but by all of the people available. But there has to be, I think, training ongoing, another layer. I don't know what kind of plan they had in New Orleans. I agree with Senator Johnson, you can't control the behavior of people, but I think if there is adequate rehearsals, so to speak, that hopefully we will save lives when there is absolutely no time to act. I mean, almost no time, because the earth will shake, the earth will drop, There has to be someone there immediately. So I think this is an extraordinary circumstance within the inundation zone. So I'm talking in a kind of a limited manner. I don't know, you know, aside from that, and, you know, if there's an emergency of a fire or something somewhere else, I think nursing homes probably have done that kind of rehearsal. So I think this bill perhaps is lacking in its specificity of what we're, the area that we're talking about.
I'm going to move on. Jane Elliott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Chair Boone, and members of the committee. My name is Jane Ellen Wydanson. I'm with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, representing 57 hospitals throughout the state of Oregon. I think I'm a little too close there. I'd like to say that we also share the Oregon Healthcare Association's concerns about redundant state regulation on top of an existing system. The Oregon hospitals already participate on a high level. Most of them have self-designated themselves as health emergency care centers so that they participate with public health and first responders throughout the state to deal with all of the crises and potentials that we will see in Oregon. And they are also working with HRSA, to the federal agency, to make sure that we are prepared here in Oregon and that our hospitals are both able to care for their patients that they have during an emergency and also the other individuals that may be coming to them from other facilities or another crisis. And we think that these ongoing regulations are just another way of trying to get to stuff that we're already doing. And so we urge you to look at maybe some of the other concerns that you have, and we're happy to help work with you on those issues.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morissette.
Thank you. I believe the hospital in Newport is within the inundation zone. That's the point that I'm getting at. We're dealing with a different kind of emergency, and there are existing facilities within that danger area that I think need special concern, special oversight. I think that that hospital in Newport and other hospitals within the zone have to have a plan, an extraordinary plan that they implement immediately. And again, facilities outside the inundation zone, I'm not overly concerned about. I think that we probably have adequate coverage, but we're talking. I don't think this bill specifies what where the concern is.
Other questions?
I just want to. I'd just like to say that I think the point of the bill is, like any emergency response, is practice, 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 drill, drill, drill. Anybody on a fire department, volunteer fire department, is the only way I can speak from experience. Weekly drills, and who knows how many calls you're going to have, but when the bell rings or the pager goes off, you want to be able to just go into rescue mode. And you can't do that if you don't drill regularly and you don't have a plan that people just know where to go, who to, you know, and you don't know how many people are going to be there. In our case, in my local hospital, they may have an evacuation plan for a fire or whatever, imminent danger, but they do not drill with all the responders on a regular basis. You might have an annual drill where all the agencies join together, but it's not every day, or excuse me, every week. It's once a year, maybe, if that. And it's organized usually, I guess, by the state. But the I think the point of this bill, though, is to say that good for the agencies and services and homes and providers who have a plan, and even better for those who have a plan and drill regularly and all their players know what to do. But this is for everyone too, because, you know, it's just like what you're saying, if you don't have to, you won't in most cases. And this is our committee is trying to get our message across that we have to be prepared. And the biggest part of being prepared is taking responsibility for your own. And so all people, all providers have to do that, because the real help, where the guys in the uniforms are going to come in, won't come right away. It will be a little bit later.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you. Is it Dr. Rhodes?
No.
I saw those initials.
I guess technically.
I think so. After the initial, so I didn't want to be disrespectful. I guess what I, Madam Chair, what I'm concerned with is In your testimony I have here, it talks about current federal and state law that is already in place, you know, directing the how to do this and what should be done. It seems strange to me that that would be the case, and then when we get a bill, this entire bill is new, I mean, as if nothing is in place.
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Nelson, the bill goes beyond long-term care facilities. It also includes child care facilities, adult foster homes, that I don't feel comfortable speaking to the regulations that direct those providers. But I, as far as the bill includes health care facility as defined in this bill, there are existing regulations that govern those facilities specifically. So I certainly don't intend to mean that the entire bill is redundant, just as it applies to the facilities that I was representing.
Follow-up, Madam Chair. Follow-up. Thank you. What I'm just trying to say is, according to testimony, we already have emergency plans in place. Okay? According to the bill, we don't. And you don't have to talk about child care. OHCA, just think of that. Okay, so either this one's right or this one's right. We either do already have the state laws, the procedures, as it says here, or we don't. And I have a concern for all agencies. But if this is true, as you say, and I imagine it is it possible for us to get a copy of this requirement? Because that's what needs to be inserted into the bill.
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Nelson, that is what I would like to be able to get from the Legislative Council's office, which is what I've asked them to draft. They have a draft opinion stating their opinion on existing law, but it's not available to the committee yet because of their workload demands.
All right, Lauren, we're going to move to Mr. Bell.
Hello again. James Bielo, again, Earthquake Awareness. Ralph Monroe used to be the Secretary of State in Washington, and he was very firm. And every year he made his staff do an earthquake drill. He made them crawl under the desk. As I read the legislation in Oregon, you're supposed to be doing too. But he said they hated it, but he made them physically crawl under the desk. And he told us in 1949 a teacher took the kids out of the school and they were hit by falling bricks. And not too long ago, not the recent windstorm, but within the last 2-3 years, in Mercer Island, the Seattle area, the big windstorm was coming and they sent the kids home. And they sent them on buses under swinging power lines to homes that had no parents. And only realized afterwards that that was not very smart. When I first read this, after the 911, and that was reminded me of Lily Tomlin and the Ernestine the Operator, and Lily Tomlin had a great line, I always wanted to be somebody, but I should have been more specific. This is really lacking in specificity from my standpoint, and so, you know, when it's read, you know, rather than threat of imminent danger, I assume we're talking about fire, windstorm, loss of heating or cooling. Sometimes it's 100 degrees in Portland, and probably some people can't take that flood and earthquake and tsunami. And then you get into this down at the very bottom under 2A, under immediate. What's immediate? Because, you know, you could, I don't know if you have, maybe you have stuff that, maybe you have medicine that has to be refrigerated. Maybe you have some time to plan for it. And just as I read the final 2370, it seems they have all the requirements that people that have to do earthquake drills. And having gone through that history, everybody's trying to get out of doing it. So I don't, the bottom line is you have to not only, somebody said there's wanting to do the right thing, doing the right thing, and look like you're doing the right thing. You have to adopt the plan, but you have to know the plan. You have to practice the plan. And I guess the idea that came to me, maybe to the committee, is almost needs some sort of a matrix to see whether we're in the tsunami inundation zone or whether, you know, in fire, are these places already covered by sprinklers, or, you know, those issues? After the school drills are required, somebody from the City of Portland school called me up, and she said, well, what are we supposed to do with the wheelchair students? They can't get under the desk. So unless you, and there's a big problem, I believe, in these categories, in that you have a high turnover of help staff. And I look at it almost like an OSHA requirement for the safety of the people working there. And to the extreme catastrophe in Mexico City in 1985, after 3 weeks after the earthquake, a teacher said to one of the emergency responders, what am I supposed to do with my students? Their parents had been all killed. So there's a huge thing that you could do in pre-planning, but I think it almost needs a matrix to kind of focus the thinking before they adopt the rules.
All right, I'm going to call up, we have some more presenters, Dr. Grant Higginson and Nicole Palmater. Is that close, Nicole?
Very close.
All right.
It's not the easiest thing in the world.
Good afternoon, Chairs Verger and Ann Boone and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I am the administrator of the Office of Community Health and Health Planning, State Public Health Division, Department of Human Services. And I am here today in support of House Bill 2371, which would require the development and training on emergency plans for dealing with cases of imminent threat. And I'm here actually because I have interest on two different reasons. One, my office is responsible for the program that licenses healthcare facilities, and also, and actually more importantly, the State Public Health Division is responsible for preparedness activities related to health and medical issues. Fortunately, we in Oregon have not, in the recent past anyway, experienced a major catastrophe. Unfortunately, other parts of the country have, and I think one thing that we've learned from the experience with Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans is that there were some facilities who were not planned for the disaster and who did not prepare enough so that they could not respond adequately. This led to cases of abandonment of some clients and in some cases even to death. You've heard today already that there are some concerns being raised about redundancy, and I share some of those concerns as well. However, from my perspective, my concern is are there potential inconsistencies and gaps in the requirements? You know, I personally feel it's just critical that all facilities that are caring for vulnerable individuals do have a plan and know how to use it. And I still need to get more information on this, but at least what staff are telling me is that we aren't there yet. We aren't at a place right now where all of these facilities do have those requirements, and that's why we support the bill. It is clearly not the department's intent to do duplicative work or to set up a system that has new burdensome regulatory requirements. Ensuring that these things don't happen, I think, can take place and be dealt with during the rulemaking process. However, you know, we would also be certainly willing to work on amendments to the bill if the committee thinks that that's a better way to deal with those concerns. And with that, I'll close and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much for that testimony. I think that that's probably the direction that we will be going, because we have at least a couple of members of the committee that believe that the bill lacks the specificity that they would be more comfortable with. I will like to reiterate what you've said, though, in that there are facilities that are not prepared. And the thing that worries me about the bills that have been worked on in the interim is that this committee needs to very rapidly move as many of these bills out so we will be prepared. We could still be talking about this when this ground starts shaking under us, and I have a little concern. Government does that, you know. And so thank you for your testimony. Nicole?
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson, excuse me.
I guess in response to the chair's very wise words, and I'm glad to see that we're headed in that direction, my question would be, you think this is important, this is in your portfolio, what date does rule promulgation start?
Chairs Boone and Verger and Senator Johnson, you know, it really would depends on what other responsibilities were given during the session and where that falls priority-wise. But clearly this is an issue that we are concerned about. We are working, you know, with hospitals, with other healthcare facilities, as was mentioned in previous testimonies, to make sure things are in place, and we will continue to do that work. But we get to it as quickly as we can, but I can't give you a date right now.
Madam Chair. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. Dr. Higginson and Nicole. You're bound to have state and federal laws with which you have to live, right? Therefore, since safety is a top priority in this state, anything we do, will you please tell me that we do have in place an emergency preparedness plan as we speak? Some type of emergency preparedness plan at each one of these facilities?
Madam Chair and Representative Nelson, I can't tell you that in every facility there is an emergency plan. What I can tell you is that the State Public Health Division does have a statewide emergency plan dealing with preparedness issues. Also that every local health department has a preparedness plan dealing with health and medical issues. And I can also tell you that we are working through the HRSA grant, Health Services Resource Administration grant that we get to work with hospitals and other parts of the healthcare system to make sure that we're moving forward in that preparedness. But I cannot tell you that all of these facilities do have an emergency plan and are exercising those, and I think that's the point of the bill.
All right. Nicole?
Thank you, Chair Berger, Chair Boone. For the record, my name is Nicole Palmateer with O4AD, the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities, representing the 17 area agencies that cover all corners of the state. And we're just here to briefly go on record that we obviously support emergency preparedness for vulnerable populations, but to reiterate Senator Morissette and Representative Cowan, we feel that discussion has to go beyond facilities. Oregon has a great tradition of home and community-based care. However, a lot of the things that we look at in terms of emergency preparedness don't necessarily go to those people who are in their homes, who have a very important requirement for electricity or transportation, meals to get to them, things like that. And we just want to be able to take this opportunity to say that in emergency preparedness for the state, we hope that discussion starts here and continues to be broader than just facilities, broader than some of the, you know, narrower issues that we've looked at, because we need to be ready for the quote-unquote everyday emergencies that we face every year in Oregon, such as ice storms, wind storms, snow storms, flooding, things like that. And we hear over and over again about the urgent concerns of the people that we represent when those things do come about. So we hope that this will just be the starting of a broader conversation on behalf of our seniors and people with disabilities.
Thank you very much for your testimony. If there is a burning question, I will keep the call at the... Senator George says he has a burning question.
This is back to Grant. Grant, I know this is politically incorrect, but I'm going to ask it anyway because it's never stopped me before. If I was concerned over terrorism and I had facilities I thought might be a target, and I would think seniors and children would be the number one target, do we have any mechanism to allow someone to get appropriate training for someone with a weapon to defend that facility, inside the facility? I mean, first of all, if I was running the facility, I would ask, who has a concealed carry? Can I get you certified to work in this area? I see you smiling. Are you negative to that concept?
Madam Chair and Senator George, no, the reason I'm smiling is because I just can't answer that question. I just don't know what the legality is. I'm not sure if someone from the law enforcement side or emergency management side would be able to answer that, but I can't.
No answer.
All right. Can maybe when we get Ken out, okay. Let's say that, and we'll spring it on.
He's the right. One that does have
Thank
it.
You so much for your testimony. Committee, we're going to have the Representative Cowan, Senator Morissette, and others that would like to express some specificity with this bill to our administrative assistant, and we'll be working, and also I would ask that you include Dr. Higginson so that we can get the bill where the committee is more comfortable with it. And with that, I'm going to close the public
Madam
hearing
Chair,
on House Bill 2371. Yes.
Just a comment to good Senator George. I am carrying AR protected.
I know.
Oh. All right. I'm going to open the public hearing on HJR 5. And, Jim, if we'll talk a little bit about HJR 5.
Yes, ma'am. House Joint Resolution 5 encourages the City of Portland and the Port of Portland to contract to locate the USS Ranger in the area and enter into long-term lease with the USS Ranger Foundation Museum.
I had that in mind.
All right. I'm going to call up Roger Carstens, Ray Cooch, and Tim Myers. Steve, would you like to come up? Maybe they can fit four in there. He's with the Ranger. Where is he? Is he here?
He disappeared as usual.
He did? Okay. All right. That's fine. We'll just keep moving.
Madam Co-Chairs, Berger and Boone, and distinguished members of the committee, my name is Ray Cutch. I'm the president and CEO of the USS Ranger Museum Foundation. The purpose of the USS Ranger Museum Foundation is to bring a world-class tourist attraction, educational center, disaster control center, naval and aerospace museum, civic complex, and veterans memorial to the Portland metropolitan area. We are a 501(c) corporation and established in 2001 for the specific purpose of acquiring, preserving, and placing into operation the retired aircraft carrier USS Ranger as a floating centerpiece of an aircraft carrier museum. Basically, the foundation is seeking support for the site determination, acquisition, and development of this landmark in the Portland, Oregon area. A couple of things, first of all, that we can bring to the state of Oregon and the city of Portland. We'll bring a world-class tourist attraction. We talked about it earlier. It seems a shame that the number one tourist attraction in the state of Oregon is an Indian casino. We anticipate outdoing them. We anticipate bringing 300,000 to 500,000 visitors a year, new visitors, to the city of Portland. We anticipate bringing at least $5 to $7 million per year in new revenue to the city. We have talked with POVA and have gotten their support. We anticipate making this a large schoolhouse. And with regards to our financing, we will be self-supporting. We are seeking no public money. Once we get the determination that a site can be had in Portland or in the surrounding area, we will not seek any public funds. We will be totally self-supporting. We will rent, lease, or buy the property that we use. With regards to what this committee, we can do for this committee and your area, I would like to introduce Captain Roger Carstens. He will go into what we can do as emergency procedures, disaster control.
Good afternoon, folks. The last time we were in front of the committee, obviously there are different people here. We went off on a direction for the committee, I felt, getting away from the museum idea because of the platform that we intend to bring into Portland to provide for an emergency preparedness utilization. And that platform starts with, at the top, the four-acre flight deck. We feel, in talking to the emergency preparedness people in Homeland Security, anti-terrorism, and any other natural type disasters that might occur, that we can offer a tremendous facility to the city of Portland and the state of Oregon that would be unique to the entire Northwest. and that is a command and control center that is set fixed on the Willamette River and could be utilized for both or for fire, medical, police, military, and what have you, anything that would concern or deal with the trying to save people's lives. The ship has a fully functional, should it be placed into operation, emergency operating room capability, 70 beds, trauma center, and a myriad of other possibilities where this ship could be utilized, provided that somebody wanted to come in and go ahead and equip the ship accordingly. If there are any questions, we'd like to answer those, but otherwise I'd like Captain Myers to continue.
Tim, please introduce yourself.
I'm Tim Myers. I'm a retired Navy captain. I was the executive officer of the USS Ranger from 83 to 85. I gave 30 years of service and retired as a captain. Spent a lot of time on ships, airplanes, that type of thing. And I am the executive director of the project at this time. Madam Co-Chairs and Committee, I'd like to share a couple things with you. You know, emergencies are part of a Navy ship. We have to deal with emergencies. If we have a fire or a disaster of any type, we don't pick up the phone and call 911. And if we do, nobody answers at the other end because we're out in the middle of a pond somewhere and we have to take care of all this stuff ourselves. We get very adept at handling emergencies because we practice them all the time. Every day on a Navy ship, we practice for emergencies. And we've come up with the five P's, proper preparation prevents poor performance, and we go by that. And by being in this position and bringing this ship to Portland, not that we would have all Navy crew on there, but we would have a lot of people on there in the way of volunteers and other people who would help to prepare this ship for a disaster. So when the disaster came, we would be an integral part of the team that would take care of this disaster. Also, we would be in the river directly available to the city of Portland where the disaster could be it a terrorist attack or be it an earthquake. The average citizen really doesn't have a clue what is going to happen when a disaster befalls them, and we found that out with Katrina. And when Katrina finally got things kind of under control, even though they were never under control completely, was when a big U.S. Navy ship arrived, the USS Iwo Jima, which is an LHD slightly smaller than the Ranger. And when it came, they had a place to put everybody, to put all the organizations together and have a command and control. They had a place to take in emergency cases that needed ICU. They had food, they had water, they had all these type things. That happened about 2 days or 3 days after the hurricane had come through. What you have in Ranger, if you have an emergency, and we have practiced for an emergency, you have a hospital. And in this hospital, we can hold up to 65 people. We have a dental clinic, which could be converted into an adjunct to the hospital. We can store emergency rations for 20,000 people for 60 days. That's MREs. Now, everybody says, well, maybe you need hot food, you need all these things. In an emergency, MREs, meals ready to eat, are what we have to handle, and we can do that. We can also store on the ship over 1 million gallons of potable water. So we have water. We have a medical facility. We have food. We have electricity, which the entire city may not have. And in having this electricity, we can run a command and control from there, and we can take the people from hospitals that will man the emergency facilities and land on the carrier via helo. We certainly, with a four-acre flight deck and shooting airplanes off there all the time, that would be something that would come with this plan.
We wouldn't be doing that in Portland, though.
Shooting airplanes?
Oh, not much. We would not.
So that is the thing that I wanted to bring to your attention, is the emergency. When I watched Katrina, I had a little different outlook, because when Mount Pinatubo blew up in the Philippines, I had command of the ship, which was an LHA, similar to the one that was in Katrina, and I went in and took all the people out of the hospitals and took them to some other place in the Philippines where they flew them back to Hawaii. So I know that what happens in an emergency, and the fact that as I listened to all the testimonies, there are not enough places that you can go if everything is disheveled and in complete discourse. So we have to find other places that you might be able to go. The carrier could probably, for 2 or 3 days, handle as many as 20,000 people. It may not be the most comfortable place, but it would be better than sitting out on the street.
Thank you all for your testimony. I'm going to, in the essence of time, ask that you step back and the people from the city of Portland and Port of Portland come up, and let's see what they have to say about it. And Mr. Bella, if you would come up at the same time. I'm going to have questions. Anybody that has a question, I'm just going to get it all out here on the front, and let's find out how Portland feels about all this. So, Mr. Bella, why don't you give your testimony first, and then we'll hear from Portland in case then we can ask some questions.
Okay. Well, actually, I just looked at it. My personal take was, well, it is a symbol of war, and maybe that would be happier at a military base. Also, I don't know where it would be, but it's a pretty huge thing. So there might be some aesthetic scale issues, but that was my reaction, that it was a symbol of war, and maybe that was something that people would want to discuss.
You want to ask Mr. Bell a question? All right. Senator George.
Mr. Bell, you've come into my office ever since I've been here, and we've talked about emergency preparedness. When I asked the question of the gentlemen that were just up here, in the ultimate earthquake that would strike Portland, what would that ship do sitting at port? And this was the answer. That's what it would do. Of all of the things that you have brought before me, this is the one thing that I really believe would solve the questions that you've had and provide for safety and security for the people of Portland. I really do believe that. I actually had you in mind when these folks first presented this to me, and when Senator Gordley kind of primarily took this under her wing, and we tried to get her here today, she couldn't be here, because of the fact that it is without question. It might have been an implement of war. Today, it's an implement of beauty, tourism, and preparedness. So that's a comment, not a question. I'm sorry about that. But I just had you in mind when I saw it.
I did have three other thoughts. One, that if you heard of the big pipe in the tram and the stormwater discharge refund, I had some concerns of whether the city of Portland would be able to manage it.
Mr. Bella, you're always thoughtful. Thank you for your testimony. If you'll step back, we'll have the Portland, and then we can concentrate on the Ranger. All right?
Good afternoon. Mark Landauer with the City of Portland's Office of Government Relations. Thank you for allowing me to testify. The City of Portland respectfully has a number of concerns with this proposal, we have a great deal, obviously, admiration for the gentlemen who are proposing this resolution. They certainly have our best interests at heart, but there are a number of issues for which we believe have to be worked out at the local level before we can take on such a huge undertaking. One of the concerns that we have with this proposal is where, in fact, we would locate such a large ship. Our understanding is that the ship is approximately 1,000 feet long, approximately 120, 125 feet wide, and approximately 130 feet above the water surface in height. Clearly, that's going to have an impact wherever you locate such a large vessel. and we want to ensure before we do in fact locate something of this nature that all the neighborhoods, businesses that will be ultimately impacted by it have had an opportunity to discuss the matter in an open dialogue with the community and ensure that the community in Portland wants such a vessel to be located within the city. We're also concerned about the how the proposal could ultimately impact the taxpayers. I know that proponents of this idea have said that there will be no impact to local taxpayers. We've asked them to provide us detailed financial plans for this undertaking, and to my knowledge, we have yet to see that to ensure that our taxpayers, at least within Portland, will not be potentially liable in the event that the projections for which the proponents have suggested aren't met. Finally, we're also concerned about the infrastructure demands that could be created by locating such a vessel in Portland. For example, are we going to have to expand street capacity, pedestrian capacity, so on and so forth, in order to accommodate such a vessel at this time? In conclusion, we're more than happy to have additional conversations with the proponents. We encourage them to do so. I know that they've been in discussions with the mayor's office. Encourage them to continue to do so. But until we can overcome these concerns at the local level, we would ask that that the legislature not move this at this time. Thank you.
Madam Co-Chairs and members of the committee, I'm Annette Price, the State Affairs Manager with the Port of Portland. And while we recognize and appreciate what the folks from the USS Ranger Committee are trying to do, it is with respect as well that we do not support locating the USS Ranger at one of our marine facilities. We have in the past met with members of their organization and have expressed our concern of locating such a vessel at our Marine Terminal 2 facility, which is in essence in downtown Portland. That particular facility is an active marine facility that in the last year has seen a 38% increase in the number of vessels coming to that berth. And so it is with that we are not supporting HGR 5 at this time and have so given that response to the members of the USS Ranger Committee directly.
All right. I thank you for your testimony. Questions? Senator Johnson.
Well, I'd like to start by acknowledging and thanking Captain Myers for his service. This is a very intriguing idea, but the threshold question is you want to occupy somebody else's very precious space, and the somebody else's don't want to be occupied. And it seems to me that for the legislature in toto to opine on this issue is completely inappropriate. I think any of us would be outraged if we found the legislature weighing in on an issue that would land something this big in the middle of one of our communities. And I think this is the subject matter for private negotiations between private folks. I don't know what other options up and down the Columbia have been explored, but I think this is completely inappropriate for the legislature to try to insinuate ourselves into what ought to be private negotiations.
I can understand Senator Johnson's concern about this. I think the feeling of the interim committee was that there would be a resolution, which is not anything binding other than to say to you that we've heard their testimony. We think that this is a great idea from the emergency management preparedness standpoint. If you don't want to talk to them, that's all right, but this resolution would just simply say what the interim committee thought. It's not anything binding to you, as you well know. Other questions of either of these, Representative Nelson? And then I'm going to also ask if you have questions for the three gentlemen who are from the USS Ranger, I can bring them back. All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I hope you bring them back. I think they're awesome. I just want to say this, if I could, Madam Chair. Everything I've heard that's negative right now, of course, that always just
does something to me. I can't handle it, really. But I just want to say, when I thought we ought to have the Evergreen Museum, everybody treated me the same way. And I think every one of y'all have to appreciate the Spruce Goose Museum. Everybody said it couldn't be. Of course, that's a warbird, Mr. Valley. And, you know, thank God for it, or we wouldn't have a 747. And there's some precious culture, precious history, a lot of lives lost. And if there's anything more fitting for a port of Portland, I can't think what it would be. What a history lesson for our children. What a memorial to our seamen who lost their lives and to those who served us and are the reason we can speak English. It is an incredible tourist attraction, and I have to say at this time to both our chairs is that this is not new to the administrator, Jim Keller, and I, because I brought this to our Veterans Committee early last during the interim. And, of course, at that time, we just thought how incredible it would be to move it there. And I believe our administrator served in the Navy. Did you?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So just being able to evaluate this opportunity, just incredible. I really cannot imagine what Portland thinks they're going to do in an emergency. They're certainly not going to come through Dundee and Newburgh. I mean, we can't get one more car in there. The bridges are going to be out. What are you going to do for these people that need emergency service? And to have a city, a floating medical city, ready to go, I think is your best insurance policy. So I'm going to hope, Madam Chair, that this issue stays at the forefront. I think it's an incredible opportunity for us. We're not going to fly that Spruce Goose, unfortunately, around the state. Likely wouldn't be a very good medical facility either, but we can use this, and I want to thank the men for bringing it forward. I do want to ask something about finance when we have a chance, when the men come back.
All right. Are there any other questions for these two? We're running out of time. All right.
I'll be brief, Madam Chair. My family and I, we went to Hawaii a few years ago, and we visited the Arizona and the Missouri, and it was a great memorial to the men and women in our services, and I'd love to have a memorial. I must say, though, I looked briefly at the naval men's plan, and I think it's ambitious, and I think the money they're talking about, though, is just to have the museum. The money for the Emergency Preparedness Center would, I think that's a whole different budget item, and I don't believe it is ready to go right now, pull up, and we're ready for an emergency. And I have to share I represent several thousand Portland people, and I do share the good senator's concerns about us just opining about a working port in a city that hasn't went looking for it now. If we could find a way, I agree with the representative's sentiment about some kind of memorial. I just want to be careful about how we go about doing this, and I just want to say I have some reservations too. But as far as, and I am interested in how this ambitious plan of funding the museum, you get it there, then what if that plan doesn't, what if that money doesn't get raised? Then who's going to tow that ship back out of there? I think that's a real serious question to ask. And we've had cases in the state where we have a beautiful, up in Silverton, we have a beautiful garden up here. And it was a very ambitious plan, and I support that garden, and I'm willing to do it with a lot of taxpayer dollars, but the plan did not come out the way those nice people thought it was going to, and now we're stuck holding the bag. And I don't want to beat up on Silverton or the Oregon Garden, but I have reservations, so thank you very much.
I'm going to use the prerogative of the chair, and I'm going to close the public hearing on HJR 5. And I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2370. Jim, would you tell us about House Bill 2370?
Yes, ma'am. House Bill 2370 creates the Office of Homeland Security and Emergency Management in the Oregon Military Department. abolishes the Office of Emergency Management and transfers the function to the Office of Homeland Security and Management. Declares an emergency effective on passage.
Welcome, gentlemen. Please start.
Co-Chair Berger, Co-Chair Boone, members of the committee, for the record, I am Major General Fred Reese, the Adjutant General of Oregon. I would like to begin by thanking both you and the members of the Joint Interim Committee on Emergency Preparedness for their efforts to understand the challenges facing Oregon in the areas of natural and man-made disasters and homeland security. I will be brief in my comments today. The bill before you, House Bill 2370, as you know, was introduced by the Interim Committee. It would place Oregon Emergency Management and a portion of the Criminal Justice Services Division that manages Homeland Security grants within the Oregon Military Department. The Oregon Military Department is home to the Oregon Army and Air National Guard, who, aside from their recent prominent roles in the deployments to Afghanistan and Iraq, have played a critical role in preparing for and responding to natural disasters here in Oregon. Oregon Emergency Management, likewise, has as its central role assisting local governments and state government to prevent, mitigate, prepare for, respond to, and recover from natural and man-made disasters. The missions of the Oregon Military Department and Oregon Emergency Management are very complementary, as our training needs, our planning efforts, our exercising responsibilities, and our roles during small or large-scale disasters. It only makes sense to have those charged with the emergency preparedness role to be housed under one roof. The model contained in House Bill 2370 matches the structures in Washington, Idaho, Alaska, and Montana. And I would say very similar to 23 other states out there, but specifically in our region, Washington, Idaho, Alaska, and Montana. These states are our regional partners, and by having a similar structure, our ability to work together during times of regional crisis will only be enhanced. Governor Kulongoski, on June 22, 2006, facilitated a better working relationship with our partner states by officially designating the Adjutant General, me, as the state's Homeland Security Advisor, which emulates the structure in the states that I just mentioned. The model in House Bill 2370 has proven very effective in the region, and we expect it will allow Oregon to make substantial headway in preparing the citizens and visitors to Oregon for the worst while we continue to hope for the best. There are, of course, other significant advantages associated with the change in structure. Moving Oregon's Homeland Security and Disaster Coordination apparatus within the military department will eliminate the need for a new agency structure, while at the same time it will create a clear, experienced, and tested command structure during emergencies, which will provide support to Oregon Emergency Management in executing their mission. It unites response and planning, which will eliminate the potential for confusion and delay in emergency response at the state level and will facilitate inclusion of military department response capabilities in all disaster and large-scale emergency response plans. Additionally, the Oregon Military Department can provide substantial resources to help Oregon Emergency Management to plan, train, and exercise its plans and procedures. Moving emergency management under the Oregon Military Department will also consolidate lines of responsibility and communication with the local and federal level, as well as with neighboring states that already have Homeland Security oversight within their military department structure. The Oregon Military Department is the most experienced state agency for rehearsed response and has the ability to respond the fastest with the most resources to support first responders anywhere in the state. As such, it is a perfect host to our Homeland Security and emergency management efforts at the state level. The department has had hands-on experience not only in responding to Oregon emergencies such as the floods of the late 90s and wildfires, it also was central to effectiveness and effective response to the crisis in the Gulf Coast during Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. I think it important to make a couple of comments for the record that would help clarify some potential confusion about the effect of this legislation. While House Bill 2370 transfers Oregon Emergency Management and a portion of the Criminal Justice Services Commission from the Oregon State Police, it does not make those entities or their employees military. They will retain their civilian status. This means that they are not subject to federal mobilization, as is the case with the men and women serving in the National Guard. The bill determines where emergency management services are located within state government, but does not change the way those services are provided at state or local levels. Though we certainly expect the state's response to emergencies will be more efficient and effective and capable of providing more integrated resources under the new structure, it will not change the way the state participates in the incident response system. That is the foundation of emergency response in Oregon and the nation, and nothing in House Bill 2370 will change that. For local government, this must and will be a seamless transition that will not change the way they do business within the state. In fact, with the exception of some of the Criminal Justice Services Division staff, there won't even be the need for the physical movement of the staff, as they are already co-located with military department personnel at the Anderson Readiness Center here on State Street in Salem. And allow me to close by stating how excited that we are at the Oregon Military Department for the opportunity that House Bill 2370 provides. We have been operating by interagency agreement since October 2006 in the anticipation that the legislature would formalize this structure during this legislative session. We have had several joint meetings between the Oregon Military Department, Oregon Emergency Management, and the Criminal Justice Services Division staff, including a visit with our counterparts in the state of Washington to see how they have been able to effectively work together. We have discovered a genuine excitement among these hardworking, dedicated individuals who have been charged with preventing loss of life, property, protecting the environment, preparing for and responding to disasters, and directing recovery when such disasters arise. I have every confidence that the restructuring identified in House Bill 2370 is one that can only result in the state doing a better job in fulfilling these critical roles. I thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you. Co-Chairs Berger, Boone, for the record, Danny Santos, Policy Advisor, Office of the Governor. And I just want to be very brief and express the Governor's thanks, not just to the state agencies who have worked this past year on this, but also to the committee during the interim who worked on this and has come forth with this piece of legislation. The Governor is very supportive and looks forward to the implementation of this legislation. And again, I think I want to thank General Reese, the Military Department, Ken Murphy, OEM, and all our partners at the local and federal level, as well as our colleagues in other states, in working to get this accomplished, and we look forward to getting this implemented. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dan. Jim?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ken Murphy, the Director of Oregon Emergency Management, and I will be very brief. I think I've talked to a good share of you and many other people. And I think this is the right thing, and I want to just emphasize that it does not change how we do business in the state. What it does do is it provides me an organization and a platform that will enhance my capabilities and provide the many different levels of support that I need for planning, training, exercise, and equipping in my role to help both state government and local government be better prepared for disasters. And although I spent 29 years in the National Guard, which may make me biased, I do understand the structure, and I do appreciate it, and I do know that it can really support my efforts, my staff efforts, and make us a better organization. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions?
More of a comment. And as we're at the end of our day, thank you, everybody who's come forward today. And if you haven't been part of this thing all along, which some of the newbies are here on the committee, I totally feel for you because it's a steep learning curve. But what I wanted to say about today's package of bills, they're all part of the big picture and what we see as a big help and a step forward to prepare our state for an impending and imminent emergency that we have been told it's not a when, it's an if. Or not an if, it's a when, it's tight. Anyway, it's going to happen. So with that being said, I think the whole point of the 911 issue, the smaller, you know, planning than you guys do in the facilities for health care and child care and all the rest, and the ranger providing a place for people, if you will, if things fall apart, but in the meantime providing something, you know, that which is revenue producing, we would hope people would find it interesting, like the Spruce Goose and McMinnville area. And then finally this piece that puts it all together so that we trust you. Actually, will be the Bolshoi Shishkas and tell us all how to put this together and save us all, to be blunt. But I think that's the whole idea, is this package of pre-session filed committee bills is the culmination of this committee's work in the interim, and to actually get something going, because as we've gone through this, we've been surprised by our scientific experts, our, you know, emergency management department, and all the other pieces and parts that have come before us. And it was depressing, and then it was really scary to know that we really aren't prepared as well as we might be. But I see this as part of this whole thing. This is what we want to do. This is why this committee exists. And it will help us move forward. So thank you.
All right. Other questions? All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for your testimony. This bill has come to the committee. Let's see. I'd better finish this quickly, the last two, James Bella and David ACLU of Oregon. I'm going to ask you to be very brief so that we can wind up here.
James Bella, Oregon Earthquake Awareness. I had a couple of thoughts when I read this. So one thought was the image of the Plains Indian as the sod buster tilled up the soil, and he looked at him and said, "Wrong side up." And I really, I really feel bad about this bill. Another thought was James Lee Witt. He gave a talk at the 100th anniversary of the 1906 earthquake. My grandfather was in that 1906 earthquake. And James Lee Witt said, he talked about when he had been at FEMA and responding to floods and whatnot. People would be in the local stores with their blue FEMA jackets on, and how much respect and admiration they were getting. And he said he was getting calls from all over the world saying, "What's happened to FEMA? What's, you know?" And I mean, no disrespect to the military people, but I was also troubled. I like OEM, and I was trying to make this acronym work, DOSIM or HSIM, and I was really troubled by Section 3, Number 2. The Adjutant General, with the approval of the Governor, shall appoint the Director of the Office of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, who holds office at the pleasure of the Adjutant General. And it just, it's kind of a bummer for me. And partly because a disaster is not just a big emergency, and most of emergency management is all cost accounting based, so you can get reimbursed from the federal government. But the research done after Kobe, everybody thought that the way to respond to disasters was from the top down. And the reality is, and what the Kobe research showed, is that it goes the other way around. It's the people, the National Guard is not going to be pulling people out of buildings. It's going to be the people around there who were there right away. And that's what they found in Kobe, that it was from the bottom up was the more effective model. And I think we still have states' rights, and I know the federal government wants everybody to mold themselves into this, but I don't see why we have to get rid of OEM. They're kind of more like us, and they'll energize the rest of us from the bottom up. We can still have joint exercises with the National Guard, and they can respond, you know, to the emergency, and we can practice that. And if the governor declares an emergency, we can call out the National Guard. But I just was really troubled by the direction of this, and the, I mean, the Adjutant General seemed to have carte blanche to do whatever he was, and I would like to see professional people recruited and trained. And
Mr. Bell, I'm going to have to stop you and move on so that I can get finished here. All right, David.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chairs. David Fidanke, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon. We're officially neutral on this legislation. I just wanted to ask you all to think about as you're involved in emergency planning and in your consideration of this bill, to think about the preservation of civil liberties in times of emergency. I am comforted, Madam Co-Chairs, by the provisions in our Oregon Bill of Rights, in light of this bill, that the military shall be kept in strict subordination to the civil power, which is in Article 1, Section 27 of the Oregon Bill of Rights, which also contains the right to bear arms for the defense of ourselves and the state. And another section which relates directly to your authority in time of emergency, which is Article 1, Section 22 of the Constitution, that the operation of the laws shall never be suspended except by the authority of the Legislative Assembly. So that as you move forward in moving the Office of Emergency Management and creating a new Department of Homeland Security, be mindful of that hierarchy, if you will, that the Adjutant General is always answerable to the governor, and the governor has limited authority in times of emergency, subject to the collective authority of the legislature, and those are critical safeguards for civil liberties in a time of emergency. Planning is everything, as you've already heard this afternoon, and I can tell you that the ACLU has been working very closely with a number of state agencies to make sure that civil liberties are kept in mind as plans are developed, and we look forward to working with this new department as well.
Thank you very much for your... Representative Krieger, would you explain very quickly the amendment that you
Dash-1 amendments are being drafted now, and I don't have the wording with me, but basically it directs that civil liberty, specifically what happened in New Orleans with the confiscation of guns, is not allowed, and any agency that does that will be responsible for all court and civil costs of recovery of those firearms will be brought against that agency. So what happened down there was when they tried to get their guns back, hire an attorney. So it's going to cost you $2,000 or $3,000 to get a $500 gun back. These amendments will prohibit that. We hope to have them out by Friday, and I'll get them to the chairs.
All right. Any questions of Representative Krieger about the amendment, the dash one? All right. With that, we have, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2370, and I'm going to open a work session on an introduction of committee bills. You have the LC 132. We have been asked to have that as a committee bill. I will move that the committee adopt LC 132 as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Just read what the committee bill is.
Yes, ma'am.
I thought everyone had read it.
We don't have
it. Okay. Very believe it. I delivered it yesterday. I don't think you have it on the dais today.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there's one being passed around here.
Okay. This bill or draft relates to the first responder building mapping information system. It creates and implements a statewide first responder building mapping information system. It allows for the solicitation of funds. It doesn't appear to have implications to the general fund.
It's where you're going to go into the building and they're going to map the buildings. In other words, you're going into a school, you want to save somebody in the school, you'd have a map so that you can tell the hallways and so forth. It's just pay for it.
Madam Chair, I have no objection to introducing this as a committee bill, but I think if we get to a point where we discuss it, there are a lot of mapping activities going on all over the state, and I don't want to set up yet another mapping process with an indeterminate fiscal where the stuff may exist. I just want to make sure this is coordinated. the Department of Administrative Services has a giant package to do all kinds of stuff. I just want to make sure we've got some degree of coordination.
All right. This is Senator Brown brought this bill and, yeah. and wanted to have it as a committee bill. It's been moved that the committee adopt LC 132. Any other discussion? Will the assistant call the roll, please?
Senator George L. Senator Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Senator Morissette.
Aye.
Representative Shoffler.
Aye.
Representative Cowan.
Aye.
Senator George.
Aye.
Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Representative Boone.
Aye.
Senator Chair Berger.
Aye. All right, the motion carries. The work session is closed, and I will also,
please.
No other business come before this body. I'll call the meeting adjourned.